Today's program is brought to you by Firesider, a health tonic based on the traditional New England cure-all of raw apple cider vinegar and honey. For more information, visit firesider.com.
I'm Erica Wyatt, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Why is food so important? Well, other than the fact that it nourishes our bodies, we know, okay, it brings us together, it's a way to celebrate. But what goes beyond that, the real meaning of food? Maybe we'll find out today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And I know it was kind of a lofty question. Why is food so important? What is the meaning of food? Well, a lot of people spend a lot of time studying food, studying its significance, hosting radio shows about it, having an entire network devoted to it. Food is very important to us, and it goes a lot deeper than just what we put on our plate. Today, I have with me someone who has spent a lot of time studying food, and not through necessarily traditional means. She is Lucy Long, and Lucy is an internationally respected editor, the author of Culinary Tourism and Regional American Food Culture, along with numerous articles on foodways. And she has recently edited the newly published book called The Food and Folklore Reader, which is the first comprehensive introduction to folkloric methods and concepts relevant to food. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's very interesting because food and the meaning of food, people don't realize a lot of times that that's what they're studying or going after, but you have made that part of your basis of all your work. In fact, founding the Center for Food and Culture as well. This is the food and folklore reader, and folkloric studies are something I think that few people really know about or understand, even though they precede so many other faculties of study. Can you tell us a little bit about folkloric studies?
Yes. And I realize a lot of people misunderstand the word folklore. It's not that they misunderstand it, but it's used in a lot of different ways. But it is, it's an academic discipline. I actually have a PhD in folklore from the University of Pennsylvania. And I studied anthropology, sociolinguistics, a lot of different fields, cultural studies. So folklore is an actual discipline. And it studies, the definition that I like to use of what folklore as a discipline studies, it looks at the products and processes by which individuals meaningfully connect to their past, place, and other people. So that's kind of vague.
No, not really, because it's, I mean, food and culinary history, which is, you know, what I spend my life doing, in the culinary history started in the folkloric departments, really. And it's all about, you know, how food, as you say, how it connects to our lives. Everything from our dining habits to the sourcing of food to you know, sharing it with others. I mean, there's so much involved in food in our lives, for sure. But when you first started developing food studies courses, you started developing them at Bowling Green State University in the mid-90s, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that, at that time, I have to say, it was really the earliest disciplines to ever take food seriously. What did you encounter at that time, prior to that time?
When I was in graduate school in Philadelphia in the mid-1980s, we used food as a subject, to study cultural processes and a lot of, you know, theories and concepts and all. You know, but people didn't take food seriously.
Right.
So what I was doing was using food to study ethnicity, regional cultures, to study concepts. And then I was teaching in the popular culture department at Bowling Green State University, and I was teaching courses on things like material culture and narrative or introduction to folklore. So I would always include a section on food, and I started discovering that those were really fun sections to teach. You know, students could relate to food. It can be very, very down to earth, so you can talk about very theoretical ideas through food. And we frequently would have events around the food so that we would have fun. We actually kind of had a sense of community that would develop around the food, even though they still had to take tests and be graded. So that got me thinking more and more about how to use food to teach these concepts. So people dismissed it. You know, some of the other academics and other departments would laugh at it, or they say, well, you know, isn't this something that you should be doing in the nutrition department? Isn't this home economics? A very good example of this is that in the late 1990s, there were two things. I applied for a grant to an humanities council to do a collection project on local food traditions in Northwest Ohio. And the response to the application was, food is not a humanities subject. So, which actually led me to do a major National Endowment for the Humanities sponsored project on food as a humanities subject. So, discussing, you know, how we can look at humankind's search for meaning, right, you know, through food. You know, but also, Newsweek had one of their little essays on silly things that are happening in universities today, and it talked about food classes. I like to use things like that as a challenge. So I started developing the classes more and more. And then in 2004, the New York Times had a big spread in their Saturday edition, and they focused primarily on my classes and Amy Bentley, who also went to the University of Pennsylvania and was in American Culture Studies. We were the two people that they interviewed the most. And they were saying, oh, look how fascinating this is. So things did switch, and people started being interested in it, but it still wasn't seen as serious.
Right, right. In fact, it was 96 when Jacques Pepin and Julia Child introduced their food studies course at Boston University, one of the first courses that to be accepted in the university as an actual course.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's right.
Yeah. And because they were such big name people, of course, it was accepted, but I think still wasn't taken as seriously as so many anthropologists, as we had to call ourselves at that time, or other people studying history would have liked it to be taken. So I applaud you for you know, sort of keeping barreling your way through and making these things happen. food, well, the importance of food. I mean, there's so many concepts about community and identity where food plays such a big role. And I'm thinking, you mentioned in the book, there's art, symbol, ritual, communication. What are some of the folkloric methods that are used to study food?
Well, there are several things I think that are distinctive about the field of folklore in general anyway. There actually are different kinds of folklorists, but just like the different kinds of anthropologists and different kinds of historians. But the history of folklore is that it comes pretty much, it actually was the foundation of anthropology. and then there were a lot of anthropologists who were also folklorists in the 1800s, early 1900s. But the other strand is literature. And it, as a discipline, was really developed in Europe, where people were studying peasant traditions and peasant cultures. So they would collect, peasant traditions, expressive forms as data. When they started doing similar types of work in the U.S., they're not peasants. So different types of questions arose. So folklore has these connections to other disciplines, but part of what makes it very distinctive is that it's looking at individuals, at personal experiences, and at individual interpretations of events, material objects, of rituals. So it looks at the individual as an agent in creating meaning, and that people act upon what they think something means. So in order to understand processes and understand what has happened, we need to talk to people and understand what they think happen and what it means and how it impacted their lives and how they then acted. So that means there's a lot of field work which involves talking to individuals. So we tend to not do a big survey like a sociologist would, and we do community studies just like an anthropologist would, but we do tend to focus more on the individual. The other thing that distinguishes folklore from some of the other disciplines, and we're all very connected and very intertwined, so it's kind of hard to draw these hard and fast lines. But the other thing that distinguishes folklore as a discipline, and particularly the folkloric study of food, is that we pay attention to food as an aesthetic activity and event. So we look at creativity and artistry. And so part of what that means in terms of food is that if someone says, I eat this because I like it, we do look at liking and taste as an aesthetic experience. And that is shaped by all sorts of historical things and power structures. But on an individual level, too, it's an aesthetic experience that can transcend all of those histories and structures. But then also, part of folklore is very, very grounded in the field of sociolinguistics. And part of our understanding of how people create anything. So if you're creating a recipe, for example, we can look at this from a sociolinguistic performance model. And what that means is that every time a person is making any kind of choice, they are drawing, first of all, from a pool of all the choices available to them. So say for example, you're hungry, you want some breakfast. Okay, depending on your culture, you're going to think of breakfast. Okay, pancakes, eggs and toast. Okay, however, if you think breakfast and you have grown up in Korea, you think rice, kimchi, fish. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's how your culture gives you this kind of pool of resources to choose from. And then you look around at the immediate context and say, well, I would like to have bacon and eggs. However, I only have eggs in my house, so I'm going to have eggs. You know, or I have a vegan living in my house, so I'm not going to have eggs and bacon. I'll just have the toast. Okay, so every single action that, every single choice that people make is taking into account that original pool of choices available and then the context. Okay, and this isn't something that, you know, we don't work through this every single time we have a choice. You know, we're trying to decide coffee or tea.
Right.
You know, we don't, my cultural background, a lot of this is very implicit. Yeah, but we're very creative when we're doing that. You know, it's not just based on logic or economics. You know, we are taking into account aesthetics and our own creativity.
Right. So it's interesting because all of these things and the food ways in a broader sense. Certainly there were historic studies on regionality, what people ate. Well, the America Eats Project, I mean, that people went out, and that was years and years ago, but they wanted to know more. It was more about availability. What did people actually eat, and what was, you know, what separated the regions from one from another, made them distinctive. But you're talking, this goes much deeper. This is taking into account, as you say, materiality, sociolinguistic, as you say, the sociolinguistic model, and the whole individual, and that I think is very important to know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you know the collection projects that folklorists have done, you know, they were collecting data. Some people just stop with the collecting, partly because you start getting involved in these things, and there's just so much. And then frequently, if you're working with individuals, there's so much to be done. It's hard to keep going and going further. You know, but ultimately, the question of, well, what does this stuff matter? You know, why do this? It all comes down to looking at how people were using food to make their lives meaningful. Mm. You know, beyond, there are times people eat just to survive. And there are plenty of people who are not intentionally using food as either an expression of identity or as artistic expression. You know, but they are still expressing their identity and their circumstances, their values, their histories, through their food.
That's right.
You know, I guess part of what folklorists do is we look at both those, what we would call the implicit expressions of identity and artistry, as well as the explicit ones.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And how important are oral histories in much of the studies?
They are very, very important. I should mention that folklorists approach oral history very differently from public historians or historians. Because what folklorists tend to be looking for in an oral history are people's perceptions and interpretations of what happened.
Mm.
So we're collecting their stories because they act upon what they think happened. So that's kind of different from in public history. It's more we're trying to sort through, well, what actually did happen? You know, these stories don't match up. You know, so who actually was there? So they're kind of different purposes, and then it ends up being a different relationship between the interviewer and the we refer to them as community scholars.
Right. Interesting. Well, I want to explore some of the topics that you've included in the reader for us when we come back after a brief break. So stay with us, and when we come back, we're going to hear more about the Food and Folklore Reader.
Today's program was brought to you by Fire Cider. Did your grandmother ever tell you to drink raw apple cider vinegar? It's good advice, and more common than you may think. For generations of New Englanders, a tot of vinegar was a morning ritual. Taken daily, a tablespoon of unfiltered apple cider vinegar can help support immune function and digestive functions. To the base of certified organic apple cider vinegar, Firesider added whole, raw, certified organic oranges, lemons, onions, ginger, horseradish, habanero pepper, garlic, and turmeric. They let this mixture steep for 6 weeks at room temperature to preserve the living vinegar culture and delicate flavors of the ingredients. Lastly, they blend a generous helping of raw wildflower honey into the mix. The result is potent but balanced, offering layers of sweet, tart, and spice. Fire Cider tastes great on its own or as an addition to tea, juice, or salad. Fire Cider ships direct from their online store and is available at over 500 locations nationwide. Use their store locator to find one near you and ask for a free sample. For more information, visit firesider.com.
Hi, we're back with Lucy Long, who has just edited a newly published book called The Food and Folklore Reader. And, you know, often I do these shows where, because so many times listeners write in and say, well, what would you tell me to look at or read to pursue a particular study in culinary history or food history, or now we have, folklore and food. And this, I thought, was the perfect topic and the perfect book and obviously the perfect guest to talk about readings and different avenues of study that people can pursue. So, Lucy, what I would like for you to do, if you would, can you explain the different sections of the book? There are really, I guess it would be four or five specific sections of the reader in essays that support that. Would you describe what they are and the meaning of them, please?
Yes, yes. The book is divided according to a definition of folklore that is usually very accepted by most scholars by a man named Dan Benamos, that is, folklore is artistic communication in small groups. So what I did was I have a first section talking about the history of folklore, the history of the study of food by folklorists, and just kind of a very brief overview of some of the theoretical issues and concepts and methodologies of the discipline of folklore. So that's section one. And then section two looks at small groups and concepts of group, folk group, community, and identity. And then section two looks at artistic, specifically food as art, symbol, and ritual. Section four is then communication. So it's food as communication, performance, and power. And then section five kind of takes all of that and looks at, well, what can we do? What have folklorists done with these ideas? And what can we do in the future? Mm-hmm. In terms of food, so that section is called public folklore, which is a whole discipline and professional field, as well as applied folklore, which is the idea of just applying folklore concepts anywhere you are. So what I've tried to do is kind of tackle some of the folklore theories that are relevant to each of those ideas. And the introductions and discussion questions that I include, I really try to summarize a lot of those ideas, and you can't possibly get it all in there.
Right.
So, and then the 40 articles that I include in here I'm trying to represent both the breadth of work that folklorists have done and the depth.
The last area that you include in there, you have a long essay in there, which is part from your book, and that's on culinary tourism. And I think that is a very good example to give people, sort of get a meaning of what you mean, to, you know, to give an example of what you mean by some of these applied theories of folkloric studies. Because culinary tourism, there's so much that people can identify with in this, in their own lives. Let's talk about culinary tourism. And what do you mean by culinary tourism, first of all?
Well, let's see. The formal definition this is a very academic definition, is that culinary tourism is the intentional participation in the food ways of an other. That's basically kind of adventurous eating, is eating something that you have never had before. So part of what I was looking at was a lot of the scholarship on tourism looks at tourism as the result of colonialism and imperialism, you know, and how tourism is possible only among people who have a lot of money, and then they usually go somewhere else for vacation and end up exploiting people, and people look at the impacts of that. But I was very interested in, you know, just as an individual, I've lived all over the world, and I love trying other types of food. And so reading this literature on tourism and thinking about myself as a person, well, I definitely was coming out of structures of power that allowed for me to be in other countries and try this other food. But me personally, when I was eating that food, I was enjoying the aesthetic experience, but I was also meeting people through that food and understanding cultures and other people better. So I wanted to look at it from a very personal perspective. What does it mean for an individual to be a culinary tourist? And then I also was expanding the idea of what is out there available for tourists. Now, this is partly because 30 years ago, I'd been living in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, and I moved to a small town in Ohio. And all of a sudden, my food choices were very limited in terms of all the international foods that I had been had access to. But at the same time, the food out here was very, very different. I would go to a salad bar here, and there was lots of different colors of Jell-O. This was very, very exotic for me. And I started realizing that you can be a tourist with all sorts of types of food. So that's where I started looking at different types of other. So you don't have to doesn't have to be another culture. Mm-hmm. It could be another region. It could be another time and place.
Could be another family.
Something from the past or the future. Mm-hmm. So, and I remember getting that idea when I had taken my three children. We were at an amusement park, and they were selling astronaut ice cream. It was ice cream of the future. All these little tiny balls of ice cream.
I remember those. Yeah.
It was a whole lot of fun, but it cost, I don't know, $4 or $5 just for a little cup. And because I was saying that's way too expensive, because they're saying, but Mom, if we try this, we'll know what it's like to live in the future. And I realized, this is culinary tourism.
Well, it has become a huge business, in attracting people. There are travel opportunities to take a cooking lesson, as you said, well, in another culture, or even within your own community, there are people starting these food cooking and dinner association where you can taste different foods right within your own community. So I think it's that conscious, as you have mentioned, you know, that conscious seeking of another flavor, another food, another, you know, and how does that relate to you? And I think that's a whole other, you know, type of sensory experience and sensory domain, right? And I like that. But well, how about you mentioned the past, connecting with the future and connecting with the past. How do these folkloric studies and maybe even you mentioned culinary tourism help us connect with our past and really study the history of food or culinary experiences?
Yeah, most of the articles in the Reader and most folklorists look at traditions and food traditions. And what we mean by that are sets of practices and attitudes that are coming from the past and have continued into the present. And so we look at why do people do those things, how have they adapted those practices to fit new circumstances, new conditions. So how do they use those practices to give them a sense of being connected to the past, or in some cases, people are trying to split with the past and create completely new presents. But even in that way, the past is still present because they're thinking about it. Yeah, so we look at something like Thanksgiving. This is a ritual dinner in which people choose menus based on what they've had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means personally, as well as what is culturally the norm, and what is available. So what we tend to study would be those sets of practices and what people say they mean to them and why they're doing it, why they participate in them.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at the past. We're kind of like historians, but we're much more interested in what the past means in the present.
All right. I can see where that, too, is, as you had mentioned, in culinary tourism, a means of evoking memories, and you just described that so well with a Thanksgiving dinner, right?
Good. Well, and I guess the other thing, too, is that, not all folklorists are advocates for other cultures, or activists, but part of what I see with culinary tourism and with folklore studies is that because we're looking at individuals and what things mean to them, this is such an opportunity to try to help people identify how they can take steps to change their personal eating habits or to change the local food system.
Mm-hmm.
So with culinary tourism, I really try to see it now as a way to learn more about the processes of culture,
mm-hmm.
to understand more the complexity of food, or to understand more a specific culture's approach to food. So there's kind of an educational outreach component to a lot of us.
Well, I think I agree with you in that the foodways, the study of foodways has become so popular, so big over the past, I guess, 20 years or so. And in this, particularly in this country, and I think it is a great vehicle for change. We've certainly seen it in a lot of food policies. Studying foodways, it's affected food policies and how we're growing our foods and what we're doing with our foods and what we put in our mouths and on our plate. In the study of foodways, so much in this country, I think people immediately think of Southern foodways. I mean, certainly the Southern Foodways has been a very active organization that has, and that is a big folkloric way of studying, cultures, habits, and food. And so many different, I can see so many different books or readers, small pamphlets published on regional foodways. Is this something you see continuing or growing?
Yes, I think so. As people start recognizing both the complexity of food and the power of food to address a lot of different issues, a lot of different concepts, a lot of different identities, I think people will be taking it more and more seriously. And the the academic programs, food studies programs, are growing.
Mm-hmm.
They actually, with the recession in 2009, food studies kind of split into, like most university programs, people had to be thinking about how can students actually get jobs.
Mm.
So a lot of the programs started being geared more towards either policy, public policy, mm-hmm. connected to systems, or even chefs and like restaurant management, tourism. So it kind of split more into almost applied and social science approaches to food systems and the more humanities approaches to understanding the meanings of food. Both of those branches are going very strong now, and people are very, very interested in them.
Right, that's great.
It was never a popular thing to want to be a chef, and now to be a chef is perfectly admirable and acceptable.
Be a rock star.
Being a chef is rock star.
Right. I think that it's certainly something that for people to, when they think of, I think initially when they think of folklore, they think of, oh, the study of festivals and lots of people dancing in colorful dresses, and not know that, not knowing that folkloric studies really, is a bit more serious than that, and that indeed folkloric studies were the earliest discipline to take food seriously, and as you have described so eloquently, engage academics in discussions of food and culture and society, And I thank you for putting this book together as well. And I think that it is a wonderful introduction for people, as well as more than an introduction. It's a more in-depth look at food and its greater meaning to us, and why the importance of food, why it is so important. So I mention again, the title of the book is The Food in Folklore Reader. And Lucy Long, thank you so much for spending your time with us and sharing your insights into the study of food and culture. And I hope to read more about it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.